Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, robotics, business, and more. My name is Aaron Goff, owner of Goff Custom Knives, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nick Frank, from the Frank Brothers Guitar Company. How are you, mate?
Good. How you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. We've had a hilarious amount of technical issues this afternoon trying to get this recorded.
We've had to listen to the intro song like 100 times.
Like an unreasonable amount of times, yeah. I actually did another podcast the other day, which was fun.
Oh, yeah. I saw you post about that. I haven't had a chance to listen.
Yeah, it was another podcast called the Rewild Gear Podcast. So, and it was interesting, like, because rather than just talking about knives, we were talking about, like, the outdoors and, like, my history, how I got into knife making, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it was fun.
That's super interesting. I know a little bit about that from back in the day.
Yeah, you've seen some of it, buddy. You've lived some of it.
That's right. That's cool. Where can we listen to that?
I think it's all over the place, but it's called the Rewild Gear Podcast. So yeah, Spotify, whatever, you should be able to find it. Yeah,
very cool.
What about you, mate? What have you been up to?
I have been up to, let's see. I've been making some progress on the fixture plate for the Haas.
Nice. It's
been challenging because Mark and I, our schedules are completely off from each other's.
Right.
Right now he can only work on weekends, and I can't work on weekends right now.
Right. Yeah.
So he's been coming in on the weekends and working on the fixture plate, and I've just been swamped with production. Right. But it's looking good, and this weekend we get to work together. I'm coming in, so this weekend that's gonna the we're gonna finish off the body fixturing, and then we're gonna make some chips and cut some actual wood.
Nice, but you haven't been doing any machining on the Haas yet, right?
No,
because you've been making the fixtures on the other machine.
Yeah, that's right, and partly because we've got, you know, our old tooling in there, and we bought limited tooling for the Haas just to get started.
Right.
And the machinable, like the actual tables are just outside, just like the exact same size as the machined, like the X and Y travel.
Right.
So to cut the actual shape of them, it's easier.
Right.
Better to do it on the axes. And yeah, we're going to do the top surfacing and, we got from McMaster, pins and, sleeves.
Okay.
So I think we got 3/4 inch. They're really nice. They have a beautiful slip fit. So anything that's going to be really high accuracy that we're going to depend on, we're going to do mm-hmm. on the Haas.
Right. Right. So you bought like fixture bushings and fixture pins.
That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah. Did you get like a round pin and a diamond pin?
Yes.
For each? Yeah. Sweet. Okay.
Yeah. And it's nice because up until now we've been making pins from phenolic dowel.
Right.
And
not ideal. Just,
yeah. And those are going into phenolic squircles.
Right.
And I mean, it works pretty good, I will say. But
did you say squircles?
Squircles.
What the fuck is a squircle?
It's a square with a round shoulder. So if you look it up.
If you're making with an end mill,
yeah,
it has to have rounded corners.
It does, but you know, we could make it a circle, but putting a round pin that relies on, like a pressure fit, not a slip fit.
It's distorting the hole.
You would have to hammer it in lightly.
Right.
It would be really, it's really hard to get those out of a hole. So by just making it square hole, square cull, it's actually a word if you Google it.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. I've never heard of that
before. I don't know if there's a Merriam-Webster definition of it.
Right.
But squircle.
Squircle. There you go. I learned something new today.
Yeah. It's on Wikipedia. So,
oh, there you go.
S-Q-U-I-R.
So it's real then.
It's real. So, and it wasn't me that put it up on that. No, Mark came up with that. I thought he made up the term.
Right.
Yeah. And otherwise, I started off the week by dropping my brand new set of calipers. Sucked.
Right at the end
of the night.
Are these like Amazon calipers or are these like Mititoyos?
No, I bought them from, they're not Mititoyos, but I bought them from Meritool.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, those green ones. I don't know. I forget what brand they are. They're like $60 US-ish.
Yeah, okay. So it's like not the end of the world, but it's not a fun.
Oh, so annoying because what I really want is a pair of Mititoyo coolant proof. Ones, but I don't use coolant, but they turn on automatically when you just move them.
Oh, okay.
Whereas the regular ones, you got to press the on button like an idiot. when I was just checking Meritool's website and I saw that they sold some reasonably priced calipers and they said they turn on automatically when you move them. I was like, that's my dream.
That's it right there. And did you like them when they're nice?
They feel great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Until you dropped them.
They felt great until I dropped them, right up until that moment.
So are they like totally boned now? Or
what? Yeah, like not even just like they're fully fried. Like the.
How did you. What happened? Like how did.
Just, you know, just typical carelessness. I put them down on the edge of a table and then grabbed something else off the table. I think I was picking up. I put them next to the camera and we take photos for customers. Mm. And the camera. Strap
just dragged them off the table
and they were like slightly open, so they hit on the face of like the tip of the jaws and then did like a full 180 and hit on the tip of the inside diameter jaws. So I can measure the depth of a hole pretty effectively.
Pretty good.
That's
about it. Oof. Well, those calipers sound nice though. I'll have to have a look on the market.
I would recommend them. They came in a nice little case, which I should have kept them in.
Well, yeah, I mean, I actually still use dial calipers.
Oh, yeah, nice.
The very first pair of dial calipers that I bought, I'm still using them. And they were not expensive. They're by a brand called Insize.
Yeah, okay.
And they've been great. Like, I'm aware that at some point I will make an off by one error. Mismeasure something. But honestly, I haven't so far, you know, so...
Okay, the Meritools are Insize, so.
Oh, they are, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like my Insize dial calipers, so yeah. I wouldn't have any issue buying digital ones.
Dial calipers look cool. They kind of make you look like you know what you're doing. You know? It's like having a analog watch.
Right. You know? I've had to rescue them once. I accidentally spilled super glue into them.
Oh, I've done that many times.
Yeah, and like on a dial caliper, because it has the little tiny rack and pinion, like the little tiny gears in there, that wasn't great, but it wasn't at all hard to fix. Like I just like popped a couple of screws off and scraped a bit of super glue out of there. It was just like a little dot, and right. then it was good, you know? Yeah,
that's lucky. I spilled like this binding glue we make all over a pair of just cheapo, like $30 calipers from Lee Valley.
Were they were dead after that?
No, they're not as nice to use anymore. I should probably take them apart.
The ones that I'm really careful with, I bought some Mitutoyo micrometers, digital micrometers.
Yeah.
So yeah, I have a 1 to 2 inch and a 0 to 1 inch of those, and yeah, I'm careful with those. I keep them in their cases.
That's smart. We just use them so much, like they just. I need like I need like a holster, like one of the, you know, like a phone holster.
Yeah, I mean the for calipers, it's not so bad, you know. Like even your $60 calipers, like you haven't dropped a pair of calipers other than that, so you can probably be trusted with them. But like micrometers, just like the 1 to 2 inch micrometer, I think that was like $400 or something.
Ooh,
yeah, not cheap. But they are sure are nice. I can tell you that much.
That's good. So, well, that was my depressing tale for the week. Otherwise, pretty good. I mean, I'm sort of trying out a bit more of a batchwork approach to production right now, which I think will transfer well when we're working with the Haas, because we expect to, you know, we'll be making parts faster.
Right.
Normally, I try to do like 2 or 3 guitars a week, but we fell a bit behind, and so I'm trying to catch up. And I'm like, oh, this is kind of nice to work on like 6 bodies at a time, or 6 necks at a time, 6 fretboards at a time. Kind of get into a zone,
yeah,
which is nice. And with the Haas, I won't have to switch tool sets like I do now. So it make it easier to do smaller batches.
Right.
But right now, working with the Axie still, it's like, oh, nice. I don't have to like switch tool sets every 3 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
To move from bodies to necks to fretboards.
I find if you're doing something like that, it's often good to try and make the quantity align with the length of a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because then you know, like, okay, tomorrow I'm coming in and I'm going to be setting up the machine to do bodies, and then I'm going to be working on bodies all day. And it's kind of nice to just have one thing in your brain for the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm actually trying as hard as I can to get away from that.
Yeah, I've gone back and forth myself.
Yeah.
Why haven't you liked that workflow?
Just because previously, you know, the issue is exacerbated when you're doing large batches. You know, if you're doing, you know, so in the past I've done batches of up to 100 knives at a time. And that has gone very, very wrong on one very notable occasion where I was working on a batch of 100 knives and I scrapped 70 of them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's... And it was because there was like a little defect in the machining program.
Right.
But I thought it was fine. I was like, you know what? This was much earlier on in my machining career. And, you know, I was like, I don't want to have to change this thing and dial it, blah, blah, blah. You know, I think it's fine. I've looked at one. It's fine. You know, I have to do some post-finishing work on these anyway, so I'll just finish it out. And it turns out it wasn't fine. I scrapped 70 of them because I was just too dumb to fix the problem earlier, you know.
Yikes. You had faith in yourself.
Unwarranted faith. Yeah. Misplaced.
You said this is future Aaron's problem.
Yeah. But, you know, like, it is, when you're tired and you're in the middle of a batch, it's very easy to just be like, oh, that tiny little thing doesn't matter, or whatever, you know, or to make some tiny mistake that you don't notice until it's too late. And then you've got a bunch of stuff
that
you have to rework or scrap or whatever, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we had a similar issue where we built like 7 guitars and we had a binding offset issue where the top binding didn't match the back binding in terms of, you know, location. They weren't aligned.
Right.
So we had like, yeah, like I think it was like at least maybe it was like 7 instruments.
Right.
I'm gonna blame auto squaring. Axis auto squaring on it to beat that horse one more time.
Yeah, you know, and I really do like the idea of One Piece flow. So, you know, for anyone not familiar, One Piece flow is kind of this lean principle of like everything should just be happening one at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, you can have multiple processes happening in parallel, but each thing should be just doing one piece, you know? And I am a big fan of that. Like it makes it really, really easy to like, you know, when a part comes off the machine or when you finish a process, like you're, you know, let's say I'm hard milling a blade bevel and then hand finishing it right after, you know, while the next one is machining. It's great to like, you know, be hand finishing that bevel and you can see any like tiny little issues or whatever, and then you just fix it. You know, like the net, you change the program and then the next one after that, it's fixed. It's
exactly,
you know, so you had like one in the middle there that was like suboptimal and you knew about it, you know, and that's it. So yeah, I am trying to get back to that as much as I can, you know, and last week we talked a little bit about, the glue up fixtures that I was making for assembling handle scales.
Yeah, that's like an exciting, revelation.
Yeah. And that's been fantastic. Like I've been using that all this week. And no issues at all. Like I don't know if we talked about it, but like the glue doesn't stick to the fixtures, which
yeah,
is nice.
That's great.
It just comes right out. So I designed the fixture. So basically it's like a rectangular channel with clamps that go over the top of it. You, put the G10 liner. So like a thin rectangular piece of G10 in there, butter up the other piece with the polyurethane adhesive, put it in there and then clamp it down. Leave it overnight, and then you come back the next morning, and they have like a little channel at the front mouth of the clamping slot where I can put a screwdriver underneath.
Smart.
So I just like stick a flat blade screwdriver under there, prize it out, just use a utility knife to cut off the foamed up polyurethane that's squeezed out, and right, then straight into the fixture and into the CNC.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it works great.
I love that.
So yeah, I just, you know, I want to get more stuff like that happening. And it's funny the amount of like support infrastructure that has to go around that. Like now I have so many different handle scales and liners, like all the different materials cut up and prepped, but I need to like have an organization system for them. Right. So I'm going to design a little like welded up sheet metal thing that has like customized shelves for sick, each of the different colors.
Right. And then you can just pull one from here, one from here, mix and match.
Yes. And I will be doing my like Kanban inventory system with that too. So,
yeah,
you know,
set your reorder.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll have like a little card in there, in between the handle scales, you know, five handle scales from the bottom. And when I reach that card, I pull it out and put it in my, you know, order this box. So the next time I'm doing a G10 order, I know exactly what to get.
Yeah.
So yeah, like I really like processes like that, but it is frustrating when you know, like what you're dealing with, where you have six processes that all have to happen on one machine. They can't happen in parallel, and you have to do setup in between each process.
Yes.
It's like hugely frustrating.
It is. And the reason we, you know, it's like, why haven't we been doing that this whole time? Like more batch work, but, we were attracted to the one piece flow thing too, even though it is more work for us, but
right,
it's better. Like at a certain point we were like, man, we just want to get like one guitar out the door, and instead of seven, not out the door, but in some state of production.
Right.
Right. So it's better for like cash flow. It's better for your like mental state, at least getting, you know, a few things done versus like, yeah, your batch of 100, which is going to take you like months to make, or I don't know.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, it's tempting, but we kind of work with these like monthly goals. So I might just have to reassess and say, what's the most I can, like, how do I actually get like a certain number of instruments out the door, right, in 1 month? Can I do batch work as a result of that? Or is like, right, if I was going to do like 12 guitars, is that going to take 6 weeks?
Right.
You know, then that doesn't really work necessarily for our cash flow. And...
I'm guessing that you're probably saving time by batching processes, like the same process together on the same day.
Yes. Given, well, given I've always done batches. It's just the number. So it'd be like, right. I'll do like two or three, like two a week or three a week, depending on the complexity of the instrument.
Right.
I've never done like one at a time, truly.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm kind of very slowly working toward is doing everything truly on demand as much as I can. So, at the moment, one change that I'm making is, for the last 2 years, I've been getting, soft, you know, like the annealed steel. So a rectangle of steel, I put it in the CNC, I cut out the internal locating fixtures, I cut out the profile, and then at that point I heat treat it.
Right.
And then I hard mill the bevels and stuff. The problem is that puts, it puts kind of like a bottleneck in the middle of that process. So I have to like get all the steel, cut it up into rectangles, then process it, you know, over some period of time. I actually run it at the same time as I'm running bevels. Like the program does both operations.
Okay.
But that means that I might have to wait like, you know, a week or something for there to be enough profile blades for me to do heat treat.
Right.
And that just gets in the way. You know, sometimes I'll run out of blades that have been heat treated, and then I have to like, you know, alter the program to do just one step so that I can scramble and get stuff ready for heat treat. So I'm actually going back to doing everything hard milled, basically because that allows me to do the heat treat earlier in the process. You know, so I can get steel from my supplier, cut it up into lengths, heat treat it, and then just keep it on hand.
So you batch the heat treating?
Yeah, unfortunately, I have to batch heat treating because it's just not practical.
That makes sense. I mean, that's the other. That's if you talk about one piece flow. You still kind of do have to batch some things, like
there are often things that you do have to batch, unfortunately.
We this is a new thing for us, but you know, we've got some people working here, and I'll have one of the guys, he joins up body blanks, necks, makes neck blanks, makes tops and backs, cuts them out. So the more stuff we can do like that, then the more it's just kind of assembling a guitar.
So you have one guy doing prep all the time.
And I've been thinking about how do we do that on the CNC as well. There's we do so much custom, but a lot of the bones of it are not customized until they get to a certain stage. So until we're putting, you know, all the necks are the same shape and have a truss rod in them, then you put a headstock overlay on it, then it becomes a custom guitar, because then maybe you're using tortoise shell or maple or Macassar ebony or Brazilian rosewood. That's when it becomes a custom guitar. But up until that point, we could batch a bunch of that stuff and just have it ready, and it's kind of like a cooking show.
And you know, honestly, I don't think that that's a bad way of doing it. Like I've been kind of doing that with my blades, for instance, right? So I'll machine a bunch of them, I'll hand sand a bunch of them, I'll tumble them, blast them, send them off for coating, and then get them back, and then they go into a box, and I basically keep stock of those.
Right.
And so that I can assemble knives on demand when people place orders.
Yeah, and then you're kind of like buying it from yourself once it's ready. I want to do more of that for sure, because at a certain point, you know what I mean? It's like, the stuff's not going to go bad, but then all of a sudden, maybe you've changed your design slightly, or your work holding.
Yeah, you don't want to keep too much inventory.
And I've been there before. I have necks here that have the, you know, we use three pins to put the index, the fretboard onto the neck.
Right.
And the pins used to be smaller and in a different location. So I've got like a neck or two with the old pin holes.
That you just kind
of no fretboards to match it. So I have those old programs, but also other things have changed.
Right.
So yeah, there's definitely a limit to that. But at the same time, we've sort of dialed our stuff in. We're not making those big changes as much anymore.
Yeah.
So you build that confidence around your processes. But yeah, I mean, you're like cutting up G10 to certain sizes. That's a commitment.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I went a little bit bigger on the length in particular than I maybe strictly needed to.
Right.
For safety.
Right.
You know, so that I could, you know, if a future process needs a slightly bigger, like the kitchen knife, for instance, if I need slightly bigger handles, like, you know, more G10 for slightly bigger handle scales, it's not a problem. Like,
right. Yeah, that's smart. I mean, we do that with our pickup rings. And we make them all for the biggest size pickup ring, which is also the most common one we make.
Right.
For a humbucker. But if you're making for a mini humbucker, you just have a little more waste, which is a bummer. And maybe we fix that down the line. But for now, it's definitely the most economical thing for us to do.
Yeah.
Time-wise and just flexibility-wise.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, you know, so like when I say that I would like to do more one-piece flow stuff, one thing I'd really like to do is have a separate CNC just for doing handle scales.
Yeah.
Because like the setup on the machine is different. I need vacuum rather than air blast, you know, because you don't want to be blasting composite like fiberglass dust everywhere.
Right.
It would be really sweet to be able to keep the chips separate so that I can do more recycling.
Yeah.
And the process for making the blades is quite long. You know, it takes hours to machine a blade. So it's really would be nice to just have that running all the time, you know, 24/7 or however much I can keep it running, and then have another machine that I can use in parallel to do handle scales intermittently, you know, because I only need a handle scale when I'm making a knife,
right?
You know, when I'm assembling it for the customer.
And that's a much faster process.
Yeah. It's like half an hour.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's what you need to do.
Yeah.
How can I get you into a Haas today?
Well, and I mean, the problem is that even a mini mill is kind of overkill because,
yeah,
machining composites is much less demanding in terms of machine stiffness than machining metals are, you know. So like a really sturdy router with a tool changer would be totally fine,
right,
for machining handle scales, you know. So that is something I'm considering building. <of course. laughs> You know, just because you know, as we talked about last week, it's kind of an awkward place, like ordering a small CNC machine for cutting composites that has a tool changer is a really awkward part of the like CNC machine market.
Right.
You know, there's just not that many out there.
We talked about Tormach. I mean, because they've got tool changing, right?
They do, yeah.
They're not the cheapest still.
No, and they're not like super quick. It would be significantly slower to make my handle scales on a Tormach than it would be on my current machines. Mm-hmm. And like the base machine doesn't have an enclosure, which is kind of important for machining composites.
True.
Yeah, there are some issues for sure. One of them is that I think that the design of the Tormach would probably be particularly susceptible to getting, dust on the ways.
Right.
So like for those that don't know, the Tormach is what's called a dovetail way machine, which means that the ways, the part that actually kind of hold the machine like constrained as it moves in a direction, are all made from cast iron and then ground, but they're kind of exposed, you know. So the G10 that I'm machining is extremely abrasive, so you'd be getting like fiberglass dust sticking to the oil and stuff of these machined precision components.
Is that the linear like movement? That's how the machine moves?
Yeah. Interesting. It's just dovetail ways.
Wow. That seems old school.
It is kind of old school. And I mean, I think the reason that they do it is because there's a bunch of Chinese factories set up to machine inexpensive machines with that process.
Huh.
You know, because like more modern or higher spec machines pretty much all have linear rails these days. So like ball bearing rails.
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, the Tormach machines seem to work okay. It's just they would require more adjustment over the long term for the wear and tear on the ways.
Well, that's interesting. I've looked at their lathe. I have a desire for a lathe.
They are sweet. What on earth would you use a lathe for?
Well, we have our own custom strap buttons.
Right.
That we shop that out to a machine shop. I would love to make a custom knob for volume and tone.
Right.
One part that I do turn is myself is a switch tip. So I make them out of tortoise shell pen blanks, and I lathe them on the drill press.
Okay, so you're just like putting them in a chuck, like the stock in a chuck.
It's square pen blank, so that makes it extra fun.
Right.
I use a hole plug cutter, cut myself a plug. First, I drill a hole in it. That's the inside. That's going to be the threaded hole to go on the switch. Then I drill around that. Use a plug cutter to cut that out.
Right.
Then I put it in. I put the drill bit back in the hole upside down with some super glue around it, and I chuck it into the drill press.
Oh, wow.
And I just turn it with a file.
Wow.
I can do it in 30 minutes. I can do one in 30 minutes.
It's not particularly fast.
No, I know. I thought it was pretty good, though.
Have you thought about... Sorry, I've just been being dog attacked here. Our puppy is running around like crazy. Have you thought about doing that stuff on the mill rather than...
I have.
Do you think you'll give it a try?
Yes, I would like to. I would still have to... I guess I could do it in two ops. Yeah.
Yeah, because for those that don't know, when Nick says strap button, what he means is, well, why don't you tell us? Why don't you tell us what you mean, Nick?
Okay, for a strap button, that is, there's two little knobs on the, on either end of the body of the guitar, and you just hang a strap from that, and then that can hang, then the guitar can hang off of your body.
Yeah. And the shape is... kind of cylindrical. It has a hole going through it for a screw, and then the outside is contoured, kind of like an hourglass, so that the strap will kind of lock into place.
Yeah, I'd say that's a pretty good description. Ours do not have a through hole.
You have like a screw.
Ours is has a threaded rod.
Okay.
But yeah.
That actually potentially makes it even easier.
I think that would make it easier in this instance, because then you don't have, for op two, you just flip it over and you're just 3D contouring the one surface.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you could totally make that if you bought bar stock, cut it into lengths, held it in like a 5C collet on the table sticking up, or like an ER collet sticking up, like a collet.
And just do it one at a time.
Yeah, or you could do a bunch of them if you wanted to. But then machine the threads. So like basically like cut the OD of it down with an end mill till it's the right size for the threads, and then thread mill it, and then flip it upside down and screw it into a second op fixture that holds it in place, and then machine the top of it. It probably wouldn't be too bad.
Yeah, I mean. It just would. It's not that expensive to have them made,
right?
Like it's under.
I'm curious. Can I ask how much it is to have them made?
They're like $7 each.
Oh, it's not too bad. Yeah.
For a pair, a pair per guitar.
Right.
Versus the time it would take to do that, and they're doing it on a dual spindle lathe.
Right, which is like overkill for that part, but it would be very, very quick.
I suppose, but
finished.
If you think about it, I mean, they're doing it in two ops. Op one
with
on
no labor. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, like, op one
got
on
a bar puller main,
op two on the sub.
Right. Look at you, mains and subs.
Yeah,
talking lathes.
I think lathes are so cool.
They are, and it's kind of crazy how much easier it is to get parts out of a lathe with no labor time, like no hands.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you get a parts catcher, and it's just dropping parts. If you have a dual spindle and a Y axis and live tooling,
you there's a lot you can do.
Yeah. You can make parts that don't even look like they were made on a lathe.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what I was going to say. I've seen some of the guys on Practical Machinist when they have a small part, you know, it's like half an inch on a side or maybe rectangular, 2 inches long or something. They'll totally like bar feed that on a lathe.
Oh yeah. And you can just make that all day. Whatever part.
Yeah. And then, you know, your automation is so simple. Like you have a bar feeder that may hold, you know, like a dozen bars or something and a parts catcher, and you just run that overnight unattended.
Yeah.
Just, you know, yeah, it's kind of crazy.
It is cool. I think that's what's so appealing about it. They also seem very scary. Like, it makes doing three axis milling seem
simple.
Simpler.
Well, so you were talking about Maritool earlier. I was watching, so John Saunders did a shop tour of Maritool.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, and so they do all of the machining of their tool holders and stuff in-house, which is awesome. But John was asking Frank Mara, the owner of Maritool, you know, like what CAM do you use to program all of the, because they've got sub-spindle lathes and live tooling, all that kind of stuff. And he's like, oh, no, I just program it all by hand.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. I'm not that.
He's literally, like, writing the G-code.
How? How do you do that?
Well, I mean, you just have to, like, know all of the different G-code commands. Like, you know, move to here, rapid to there, you know, set this offset, come back in here and cut, do this, like, canned cycle. Like,
but how do you tell it, like, if you're writing the G-code, how do you say, like, I want a, I don't know, I want this shape?
Well, so that's the problem. Like, with a mill, it's really, really difficult, right? Because you're going to have all these crazy freeform shapes that you then have to, like, program arcs for and all that kind of stuff. But on a lathe, it's much simpler. I guess for a tool holder, you're basically saying, like, you know, move from here to here. You're describing a straight line, but it's actually like an angle.
Right.
You know, and then the next bit, you're doing a shoulder and then...
Yeah. Because the, you know, the tools, it's all focused on the center of the bar.
Right? I'm not exactly sure how they would normally set offsets. I'm not a CNC lathe guy, I must admit. But the work offset, yeah, I think would normally be from like the tip of the bar and then from the center line.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's crazy to me that he still hand programs everything. But I guess, you know, depending on your quantity, it might be 100% worth it to, you know, shave every second off that cycle time.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it is for them doing so much volume. So they don't make their own end mills.
No, so they have a bunch of companies in the US that make their end mills. So I know that they use HTC for making end mills. I don't know who else they use. I know they have a couple of different suppliers for, like, I think their drills are made by different people than their end mills, for instance. But all of their, like, tool holders and stuff they make in-house.
Right.
Yeah, which is super cool.
Yeah, the tool holders are beautiful.
Yeah. Have you ordered any diamond tools from them yet?
No, I haven't ordered any, actually, any cutting tools.
Right. I think you'll like the diamond tools at some point. I think you'll like them.
Yeah, I'd be so curious to try them. And I actually was going to ask you, like, we've been using the same end mills for years. And like...
Like the same brand or the same actual end mills?
Same brand. We do get really good tool life.
Right.
But like, how are you assessing whether you need to make a change? Part of me is just like, I feel like we could maybe do better. I don't love the supplier we get our tooling from.
Right.
And I just, I don't know how to even like, I feel like I'm just so used to what we're using. I'm like scared to try something new.
Yeah.
And new, I mean like not the same style of tool. Like we use all single flute mostly. Square end mills. We use two flute. Ball nose and stuff, but like I'm just too used to that.
Honestly, it is a good question because, like, let's say you're ordering, you know, a 3/8 four flute end mill, right? Like solid carbide with a coating, aluminum titanium nitride or something for cutting steel. You know, from Maritool, that's going to be like you know, an $18-$20 tool. And then if you were to order that from like Seiko or you know, Hamer or something, that could be like a $250 tool.
Wow.
You know, is there really enough difference in tool life to make that extra $225 worth it? Like, I really don't know. I have tried some other tools and I've never really seen a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But part of the issue is that to actually be able to measure the difference, you have to be like running a process that's otherwise so consistent that there are no other variables. You know, like if you're like changing the program every day or you're doing different parts every day, like how do you even tell?
Yeah.
Where one is better than the other.
I don't know. I mean, you need like a CMM or something.
Check. Well, I
check how much tighter your tolerance is based off because of one tool, but there's also a lot of variables, right?
Yeah. There's so many variables. So, I mean, basically with Maritool, I've been super happy, you know, so with my current end mills, so they make a custom end mill for me that is 1/4 inch in diameter, 6 flutes, 60 thou corner radius, and aluminum titanium nitride coating. And I use that for hard milling. And
cool.
they don't specify it as a hard milling tool, but that's what I use it for. And I get tool life from that like other people are like, oh, you know, how many tools do you get? Like how many blades do you get per tool? Like 2 or 3, you know, like, no, I get like 12. You know,
okay.
Like I've been running the most recent tool for like 2 weeks. I think it's done like almost 20 blades at this point and it's still running fine, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. So like, I don't have any motivation to switch to really experiment, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of where I'm at. Like I just don't love the supplier. So
right.
It's kind of an expensive tool. I see cheaper ones out there. I'm like, oh, that'd right. be nice. But
and what tool in particular are you talking about here?
Our single flute downcut and upcut end mills.
Okay.
So it's a single flute helical end mill. Which
where are you getting them right now from, like tools today or something? Or
no, I shouldn't say because I chirped them.
And you just don't like that they're like. You have to like call them to order or what?
No, I don't. They've recently discontinued selling one of the tools that I use, which is just kind of annoying. I've just had fulfillment issues and, I don't know, right. just other things. It's been years of buying tools from them.
Well, so. I have a suggestion, which is, you know, I used to think that I was special. Because Frank treats me like Frank at Maritool treats me so well, I thought I was special. But I've heard lots of stories from other people of how they feel special because Frank treats them well too, right? So maybe reach out to Maritool, reach out to Frank, and just say like, "This is what I would like." You know, can you guys stock these?
Right. And okay. See if
in can... my experience, he said yes every time I've asked him.
See if he can just get the same tool. But
yeah,
just...
made by his, he'll have them custom made by his end mill manufacturer and then potentially stock them, you know, if that's something he's interested in carrying.
Interesting. It's not so a metal cutting tool. Or, I mean, I guess you could cut aluminum. I guess some people cut aluminum. It's plastics.
So it's you can totally cut plastics. Yeah. You know, so for me, he introduced all of their diamond tooling. That was at my request. He does down cut metal cutting end mills. At my request, which are very unusual. I've only ever seen one other place that sells those.
Cool. I love down cut bits.
If you don't know what you're doing with them, they're a disaster waiting to happen. But yeah, for the right for
wood,
the right thing,
it's not right. So risky.
Right. And yeah, like all of the custom tooling that he's made that I do for my that I use for my bevels are just fantastic. Like they just started making an 8 flute. Version of that little 1/4 inch tool. So you're talking about a 1/4 inch tool with only 3/8 length of cut that has 8 flutes. And I've never seen that tool anywhere else, you know, and I asked him like, oh, you know, the 6 tool version's working great. Do you think there's a benefit to going to 8 tools, 8 flutes? And he was like, I don't know. Let's find out.
Cool.
You know? So yeah, man, I would you know, I hope I'm not giving him too much work, you know, that everyone's going to reach out to him asking for custom tools, but like, it might be worth asking them, you know, because they're always expanding. So
Because we've been happy with the way these tools perform. They always like, we just found out, you know, Mark was probing diameter and they're like, some of them are well undersized.
Yes, that's pretty normal though. Yeah. You will find that with most tools are up to, you know, one thou undersized.
Oh, I think we were more than that. I'll have to ask him because I wasn't here, but I feel like the number was like 6,000.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, all of the tools from Maritool, like, generally they're going to be undersized. Like, CNC tolerance tools are usually undersized because you don't want, if you're like going to cut a slot with a 3/8 end mill, you don't want it to be oversized. But cleaning up a slot to an exact tolerance,
right,
with a cutter that's a bit smaller is very easy.
Yeah.
Right. So that's why they always make them a little undersized.
How do you check diameter if you don't have like a probe? Like, how do you check exact diameter?
I cut a pot and measure the pot and then compensate from there. Yeah. I mean, honestly, for me, I only have one operation where I need to comp for diameter, and that's when I'm cutting the profile on my blades.
Okay.
And on the profile, I'm holding plus or minus half a thou.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, just whenever I change the tools, I cut a test part, measure that. Usually it measures in tolerance, but it'll be like to one end or the other of the tolerance. And then I just dial it so that I'm aiming for the middle of the tolerance range, and then I let it run.
That's cool. Yeah. That's important for us too. The cutting a profile, the tool diameter.
Yeah. I mean, you've got a table probe, right?
So yeah, it's so cool. I mean, we've been able to probe for length, on the axes since we've had it, but
right,
knowing the diameter is just so cool. And it went on to eBay and bought a ring gauge.
On eBay? Yeah. Why did you go to eBay?
Because there's so many available on eBay. And it was, really? It's not a huge, it was, I think it cost maybe $30 or $45 to get a 1.6 and change master ring gauge. And it was so,
how much was the same thing for McMaster?
They didn't have the exact, like, oh, so okay, so for that exact diameter, it probably inside diameter would probably be over 100, maybe like $185 US or more. So it was kind of worth the risk just to get it and see if it was totally fucked. But it's not,
but how
it's
do you
nice.
How do you, so I'm curious, right? Because it's a ring gauge, so it's, you know, a pretty like high level metrology tool in terms of like,
yes,
that's one of the things you would use to qualify your other tools.
Yeah.
So how are you qualifying the inside diameter of the ring gauge?
You just have to trust that it's right.
That's what I'm saying, man. Like, why would you trust something?
Because it's a master ring gauge and it's like an XX tolerance.
Right. But I can laser engrave that on a bearing and just send it to you.
No, I mean, this is, it's made by a GSG ring gauges. It's like a legit ring gauge. Okay. People do make them themselves, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
But no, this is like a legit ring gauge.
It just, next time you want a cheap ring gauge, just let me know and I'll just 3D print you one.
Okay,
I'll write whatever.
That will
you
be a cheap ring gauge.
Yeah, 4x grade.
Yeah,
more X's is more better.
I mean, I'll send you a photo. It looks like a pretty legit ring gauge.
Right,
and it had like a tolerance, or had a from the last owner. I'm sure it came out of some like fancy machine shop, I'm gonna guess.
Oh, okay. You bought it used.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
eBay.
No, I thought you were buying like new stuff.
Oh,
right. Because like, if you buy like a brand new $35,
no, that'd be a horrible idea.
Off eBay. Yeah.
Okay. No. This is like a legit,
right,
serious ring gauge that probably would have been like $250 or $300.
Right. Yeah, I do love a good eBay find for stuff like that.
And there's a million of them on there. Like, you can, right. I got my pick of the litter.
I will say though, so sometimes I buy new stuff off eBay, but just recently I got like, not screwed, but like massively, well, not
even,
okay,
disappointed.
Let's not make this a first world problem, but I was inconvenienced by, I was buying vacuum fittings. So like, high-end, high vacuum fittings. So they're like polished stainless steel with a very specialized kind of gasket fitting on either end. And it's, I'm buying like, you know, 90 degree elbows and like flex tubes and stuff.
Yeah.
And if you buy them from a US company, we're talking like $250 a piece.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
For like a little elbow, you know, and I need like a whole bunch of them. So I went on eBay and there was a company that looks like they had them and they said, you know, US stock, blah, blah, fast shipping. So I was like, okay, cool. I'll give it a try, you know, and these are like $20 each or whatever. And turns out, like, the U.S. stock part of that was, like, total bullshit. And I ended up waiting, like, 8 weeks for them to come from China. So, like, it's kind of funny. Like, I found eBay more recently to be unreliable for stuff like that. But I've had really good luck with AliExpress.
Interesting. Yeah, I've never tried AliExpress. But it's interesting to go onto the website. I've had pretty good luck recently with eBay for a lot of things.
Right. eBay for used stuff. I love it. Like,
oh yeah,
totally. Like I bought a vacuum pump off eBay that was like $6,000 US.
Wow. New,
and I got it for $400.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And it's like, it's beautiful.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, that's when it's such a low barrier to entry. It doesn't feel like as big a risk. Like for us to spend $30 on a ring gauge was almost more of a risk to buy one for $300, considering how often we'll need to use it.
Yeah, right. I get that.
But my one concern with it was like, maybe this has been used as a go gauge for like a decade, and they
right, and that's all worn out.
Yeah, but the inside diameter looked like the inside surface looked okay. Like it's not perfect.
Right.
You don't feel any burrs or pits or anything like that. But it's definitely used.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's just interesting. Like I've ordered some stuff off AliExpress that was just impossible to order anywhere else.
Right.
Like I bought a replacement LCD screen for my Fidal machining center.
Yeah. How cool is that?
Yeah. And that was like $100, you know, but if you buy, basically the same thing from any US company. It's still the Chinese made LCD screen, but they just sell it to you for $800.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, stuff like that. It like I have really no problems buying from AliExpress or whatever.
Right. Yeah. It's like coming from China anyways. I just opened it
and
up.
And my experience has been very good. Honestly, like everything's been really fast whenever I've ordered from them. Like I've gotten stuff from AliExpress in like a week.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, if you can find it, it's not going to be like a sub-quality product. Why not? They got everything here. Yeah. Wow.
I know.
An anime
shirt.
But
going on,
I can buy a drone, headphones.
Going on AliExpress and just seeing like what's on there, it's kind of nuts. Because like, you know, everything is made in China.
Yeah.
Like you can buy stuff that's not made in China, but you can also buy everything from China.
Yes.
And some of the stuff that's on there is crazy. Like I had the idea to build my own wire EDM and I've got parts for it. I've got some working hardware, you know, like it's kind of an ongoing project, just very slow. And you can go on AliExpress and order like machined Ruby guide orifices for a wire EDM of like whatever description you want. You can buy like the wheels, you can buy the water jet systems, like the flushing systems. Like it's crazy that you can buy all that stuff and you cannot buy it anywhere else.
Right. It's like maybe these companies are making this to spec for a company in the States that's ordered them, and then their side hustle is also just selling them on this, you know, on AliExpress.
Well, the interesting thing is too that there's a lot of like stuff that's made in China for Chinese industry that we don't really see in North America.
Okay, yeah, true, true. I mean, wire EDM, I'm sure they've got lots of those.
Yeah, exactly. So they actually have a specific type of wire EDM called a fast wire, which uses, rather than using a consumable brass wire, it actually recirculates a molybdenum wire. Like it actually like reuses it back and forth. And the molybdenum wire is like way more tolerant of high temperatures, so it doesn't wear out anywhere near as quickly.
Oh, cool.
And they use them for a whole bunch of stuff, but like one of the more modern uses is when you're 3D printing metal parts. The metal parts actually get like printed on top of a steel base plate, and then you have to cut them off the base plate. So you can literally use a bandsaw, but then you end up with like a shitty bottom surface. So they actually use these wire EDMs to cut the bottoms off.
Right.
And like, there's one company that I know of that imports these Chinese-made wire EDMs into the States, and they're about $30,000 as opposed to like $140,000 of a traditional wire EDM, and they cut significantly faster. But they're not designed to hold the same tolerances,
right?
Right.
But if you don't need that tolerance, what do you need a wire EDM for, or what would you want one for?
I have this idea that it would be really sweet to start with a rectangular blank of steel, machine the bevels and everything on both sides of the blade, but not cut it out, and then use the wire EDM to cut out the outside.
That's a great idea, because then you have your reference surfaces there the whole time.
Yeah, and the fixturing is super simple. There's no customized fixturing at all. If I wanted to and I was okay with being wasteful of steel, I could use the same oversized blank for the kitchen knife and for the Resolute.
Right.
Right.
That's such a cool idea.
Yeah. I actually, I have a friend on the other side of Canada who has a machine shop and has offered to run a couple of test parts for me. I don't want to waste his time, so I haven't done it, but I will at some point. I'm going to send him some kitchen knife blanks to cut out.
How expensive is it would it be to shop that out? Like if you did that process and then just sent somebody...
I actually don't know. I will probably ask him, you know, like what he would quote on that job.
Yeah. Then you're back to doing basically big batches though.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the biggest problem with wire EDM is consumables cost.
Right.
Like you consume filters, you consume the deionizing cartridges, you consume wire. There are a lot of expenses in running a wire EDM. So
no end mills though.
No one less.
It's true. Just wire. So, how expensive is wire?
Well, it's all copper. Ah. So it's not cheap. Yeah. Or brass, right? So, yeah. So we started this episode and I thought we were not going to have enough stuff to talk about. And then we haven't even talked about 90% of the stuff in our show notes.
Whoops.
It's hilarious.
Did you want to tackle some of this before we...
No, it's fine, man. Like we've just had an episode where you and I are basically just like catching up and shooting the shit, which is really fun, I think. So
I like that.
Hopefully other people like it. You know, listeners, if you hate it, let us know. If you like it, let us know. I don't think Nick and I have any problems, you know, flapping our gums at each other like this.
Yeah. Sorry, Elon, we didn't get to your space stuff.
Oh, there's no space stuff this week anyway. So
okay.
But we did miss a bunch of good questions. We have a bunch of great questions that I guess we'll get to next week from Scott Hoadley, J. Berry Knives, Real Penny Pincher, Wing Wave Designs, and MW Blades all had questions or suggestions. So we will get to those next week. Sorry, guys. But yeah, I think we've got to call it a show there because we just hit an hour, man.
Right on. Okay, cool. Well, I'll look forward to chatting with you next week.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And at some point, we have to do this over beers. Once the lockdown finishes, which is hopefully happening soon, because everybody I know in Canada is vaccinated.
Yes, you got yours, I got mine.
Yeah, which is crazy. So hopefully a month or two, when things will start getting back to normal, which is amazing. All right, man. Well, I hope you have a great week.
You too.
I hope everyone has a great week. And we'll see you again next week.
Yeah, cheers.
Bye, everyone.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator.
Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.